Hi, and welcome to Being Lutheran, a podcast dedicated to proclaiming the excellencies of Jesus Christ and the biblical theology expressed in the Lutheran confessions. Today, Pastor Jason Goodham, Pastor Brett Bowe, and Pastor Adam Osier begin their discussion on The Bondage of the Will by Martin Luther. Being Lutheran is sponsored by the Free Lutheran Bible College and Seminary in Plymouth, Minnesota. Whatever your vocation, start here, go anywhere, grounded in God's Word.
Welcome to the Being Lutheran podcast. I am Pastor Brett Bowe, and I'm joined by
Pastor Jason Goodham
and Pastor Adam Osier.
All right, welcome back, guys. This is a fun episode. We get to start on a brand new thing.
Like a literal brand new thing.
Yeah,
as God said, behold, yeah. I am doing something new.
That's yes. right. Yeah.
What's that, Isaiah? Somewhere in Isaiah.
Yeah. The ears of who hear shall something like that? I don't know.
Yeah. Look it up. You can Google it.
We so far are not doing a new thing at all.
Yeah, right. Now, this part is not new, but yeah, if you've been listening along with us over the years, we've just finished going through the whole Book of Concord, which was, you know, when we started, it felt like we were never going to finish that, but it surprisingly came fast.
It happened.
It happened. So here we are, and I'm thankful that we didn't finish the podcast, or we're still going, but we're starting a new thing here. We're going to be walking through various Lutheran books, and the first one on our docket is The Bondage of the Will by Martin Luther.
Yeah, Luther himself has said that the only two works that he wrote that were correct and worth reading were the Small Catechism and the Bondage of the Will.
Really?
He
didn't say the Freedom of the Christian?
Or the Large Catechism, which is my favorite thing that he wrote.
Yeah.
But those are the two things that he thought would stand the test of time, and so far he's been right.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Our conversation over the next 4 weeks going to talk a lot about Bondage of the Will has a broadly ecumenical appeal as far as Reformation texts are concerned.
One time I was sitting in a hot tub in Orlando, Florida, and that is kind of the hub of some of the Reformation Bible College, you know, a lot of the Reformed, what would you say, the hierarchy, if you will. Is there a Reformed hierarchy? Lives there. It's kind of a hub there. And I was sitting there, and I told this guy I was a Lutheran. And he's like, he got in right immediately. He's like, well, Luther's one of the best theologians, and I'm Reformed. And I was like, okay, where's this going?
Yeah.
And that was his argument. His argument was The Bondage of the Will is one of the best theological texts ever written. And that was, and you can understand how that, as we progress in this, you're going to understand why that's the case. And it's true that it appeals to both sides, and a little bit for different reasons and with different application.
Yep. That's kind of the point.
Yeah.
So the layout is we're going to do a historical background of Luther, Erasmus of Rotterdam, and the situation leading up to it. Next week, we'll do a theological overview of the environment that Bondage of the Will was written and a summary of what it delivers. We'll do our Bible studies. We're going to keep the same exact format through all of these, and so that every section of every book we look at will have the two lesson plus Old Testament, New Testament format. We're not going to tear the Band-Aid off too much as far as moving forward, but we think this pattern will hold just fine.
Yeah, that's great. Well, let's get into it, guys. I think the first question is, thinking of the historical background, is just thinking about who is this guy, Desiderius Erasmus. And every time I look at his name, I see, maybe Jason will get this, I don't know about Adam, but I see Didi Gregorius.
Wow, that's a deep cut.
Yeah. No idea what you're talking
about.
He's
not an old Yankees.
Used to play shortstop for the Yankees in the Reds.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
Yeah,
you guys take inside baseball in our situation
quite literally.
In this case. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, but
I wish I was a baseball fan.
Yeah.
I do too.
This podcast would be so much more fun.
You can always start, you know.
Yeah, right. I'll do my best.
But anyway, who is this guy? Who is Erasmus?
Why does he matter?
Yeah, why does he matter? Yeah.
I think there's a reasonable case, if not maybe a little bit too biased theologically, that he was probably one of the two or three most famous people in Western Europe for a couple of decades. He was as influential as they come in a time when the church was highly influential. So, I mean, this isn't like an out-of-the-nowhere religious figure riding to prominence. It's the church dominated, and Erasmus rose up as a moderate reforming voice in the church towards the end of the 15th century, early 16th century. So he's around 14 years older than Luther. Mm-hmm. He's a Roman Catholic, started life as a monk.
Didn't want to be.
Didn't want to be. A lot of monks didn't want to be monks. Common tale. Yeah. Who among us? But yeah, he was a book nerd. Your classic Middle Ages, Renaissance era, very frail of health, delicate individual, but brilliant. Just an absolute genius and very gifted as a linguist, as a translator of Greek.
Yeah. And still his translation. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Of, you know, the Greek, you know, or, yeah.
Is it the Nestle Aland version of the Greek New Testament, I think, is still based off of his original...
The Erasmian text.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. He's an interesting guy because with Luther, he also saw some of the faults of the church. And he was intelligent enough and he could speak to these issues in a way that was disarming. In a way that a lot of people could not at that time, you know, where a lot of these guys were getting burned at the stake. Luther, we know what happened there, but he could have these conversations. And as I learned, and as we were prepping for this episode, he had a lot of close personal connection with like the papacy,
yeah.
Like even like Pope Leo X, which was the pope that of course
excommunicated
Luther. Yeah.
And the one that followed Pope Leo, Adrian, yeah. Went to school with him.
They were like childhood friends. Yeah,
like, and the so Pope is my homeboy.
It's like it's like growing up with Pope Bobby in Chicago.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I wish I could say I had, you know, like.
Well, we're a couple, you know, probably a decade away from being like, yeah, I'm the same age as the Pope.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, right. Yeah, is there anybody in modern day that you guys think is similar to him or like a comp to this guy? Maybe it's not a great question, but I'm just trying to help our listeners get an idea of, you know, he's like kind of like this.
A broadly appealing Christian thinker. It's really not, and it's because of what we're going to be talking about here in a few minutes. Well, we can introduce it. The problem with Erasmus as a voice is that he never actually used his voice to do anything. And so, we're just
he does strike me as kind of like Mr. Nice Guy a little bit in some ways.
And absolutely unwilling to rock the boat.
Yeah.
You know, just so concerned that he's going to step on a toe that he says, you know, a lot of mealy-mouthed things that just don't quite, you know, say anything, even though he had the intelligence to recognize some of the issues. Yeah. I think, like, okay, a couple come to mind. You said, is there a modern-day one? I think of, like, N.T. Wright to some degree. You know,
that would be pretty close.
He has a broad appeal, has a lot of things that I would agree with. His treatise on the resurrection is unparalleled, in my opinion. His argument for, I mean, other than the Gospels, but his defense of how all of these things, and he carries through the history and the eyewitness accounts and all these things, he does a great job. But then I think he flubs justification. And... You know,
and didn't he say you don't need to believe in the resurrection of Jesus to be a Christian? Wasn't that an earlier thing?
That?
I think that was earlier this year.
That, but
I could be misidentifying the issue, but he said something outlandish where, like, you know, that sort of a thing. And I mean, that's probably a fair comparison, but, you know, so rewinding just a second before we get too far into the weeds, and we'll have a link, Brett, this is up to you since you did the post.
Yes.
The version of the book we're using, The Bondage of the Will, is published by an arm of Baker Bookhouse. I don't know, Brett, you've got the 2012 edition, I've got the 2004 edition, and the publisher is Revel Publishing House.
The 2012 is Baker Academic.
Yeah, and so Baker owned Revel at the time. And so this is, we'll have a link so you guys can follow along if you want. But the key is that there's an introduction written by J.I. Packer, a very famous kind of reformed theologian from the middle of the 20th century, and someone we're not that familiar with, by a man by the name of O.R. Johnston. And we're basing these first couple of episodes off of their kind of introduction to the work.
Mm-hmm.
And so, their analysis of Erasmus, you know, you said that he's kind of mealy-mouthed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to quote directly from one of these a paragraph in this book, and this is from page 19 of the book that Brett will link to on the post. They said of Erasmus, he had a conservative turn of mind for all his clear-sightedness, and to him the revolutionary was more to be feared than the ignorant devotee of an old but corrupt system. His reforming ideals were based on an undogmatic Christianity, an eviscerated Christianity, precisely because it was a Christianity without Christ at the deepest level. The epigram is irresistible. Erasmus was shrewd but shallow, a man of cool calculation rather than of burning conviction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He could never stand contra mundum, against the world. Mm-hmm. And so he was a man that identified the problem without offering the solution, and then wanted credit for identifying the problem. Mm-hmm. And that's Erasmus. He did not want to rock the boat. Mm-hmm. He did not want to direct negative attention to him. He's a guy walk in and be like, hey, guys, maybe we shouldn't do this.
You know? So basically he's me. So, yeah.
which explains how he and Melanchthon got along so well.
Yeah, right.
Which, you went there.
I'm jumping ahead, but it's kind of true. Yeah. I'm not wrong.
Oh, funny.
I'm not wrong. And there was, you know, that... Melanchthon, I'm jumping ahead here a little bit, but you know, Melanchthon kind of was the middleman for a long time to try and make peace between Erasmus and Luther, who for a very long time, up until the issue at hand, which we will get into for the next several episodes, many episodes, but the issue at hand was way down the road. They got along. Erasmus and Luther had respect for one another. Luther, who understood the language and respected language, looked to Erasmus. And there was a lot of, they didn't want to step on each other's toes. Even after Luther had gone down the path of no return, there was still that camaraderie there.
Yeah.
And Luther, even after the disagreement between them started, like, hey, man, just stay out of this issue. This is not your department. And let's just agree not to speak negatively about each other. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that Erasmus was drawn into the conflict by a mutual enemy that he and Luther had. Mm-hmm. And so there's a guy that hated both Erasmus and Luther equally. He's like, maybe I can kill two birds with one stone here.
Yeah.
We'll get to him in a moment.
Right.
But even after the split, Luther thought highly of Erasmus's language scholarship. Yeah, like, he always was indebted to Erasmus, and he spoke highly of the Greek New Testament. And so, you know, Luther was fair to him, but Luther wanted Erasmus to do something. Mm-hmm. Like, use your voice for good. Yeah. Be a man of conviction and influence. And Erasmus wasn't a man of conviction. He wanted to be left alone to think.
Right. And maybe part of that, too, is goes back to, you know, you'll often see people talk about him being a humanist or his humanism. And I think that that's maybe helps understand the difference between Erasmus and Luther, is where Erasmus is coming from his humanist perspective. But what is that? And how can we understand his humanism?
At the very basic root of it, I mean, you're elevating the human.
Yeah, it's the good of humanity.
It's you're seeing humanity, and we're going to see through the rest of Bondage of the Will, it's elevating humanity to a level that it is not warranted to be at.
And there's probably layers of meaning. So Melanchthon is considered a humanist because he recognized the good that humanity could do. And like Melanchthon as a humanist, as far as I know, and this is an area that is out of my depth and out of my expertise, but the modern public school system in Germany is built around Melanchthon's educational plan. Like he's seen in that way. And so the most basic broad definition of humanism is for the good of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The humanists in, you know, like kind of in the way that René Descartes got the Enlightenment going, Erasmus kind of gets the humanist going, so that you, like, God is replaced by just the good of humanity.
And I think it's important to note here too, there's a lot, that phrase humanist is thrown around a lot in our culture. A lot of people would claim to be a humanist that are in no way Christian or even theological in their bent at all. I think you have a humanism now that's kind of based on atheism. But at that time, there was that, certainly Erasmus would have identified Christ as the ideal human, like the one to whom we had to aspire. And that's where some of the trouble gets in, where he says, you know, we can do that in our own will, and Luther is going to fight that. But at the end of the day, I think that that is a major piece, is that he saw Jesus as man, and because that was the culmination, he saw the incarnation as the culmination of what we, you know, the work of God amongst us. Mm-hmm. And that was something that drove his humanism.
Yeah.
Packer and Johnston go, you know, they analyze this relationship quite a bit between, you know, Luther and Erasmus as parallel reforming figures at the same time, but with utterly different focus. And then they record Luther's opinion of their differences once the conflict starts. They write, Luther goes on to explain that Erasmus had shown the world the evil of the Roman system, but was not able to show the good and lead on into the land of promise.
Right.
And I thought that was a very important quote. And it's kind of this, almost this political sphere that we see today. We have dozens of politicians that are very good at pointing out what's wrong with the system. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about draining the swamp or, you know, rallying against the elites or whatever. And that over there is wrong. That over there is wrong. That over there is wrong. But you want to look for the voice that says, and here's what we do about that. Mm-hmm. And Erasmus is the first guy. And Luther's the bull in the china shop that says, we're going to tear this down and build it the way it's supposed to be built.
One thing I thought was funny as I was reading the introduction, just kind of getting a picture of these two men, I thought of them, and I'm going to say this is not a political statement about where I stand or anything like that, but just we see in our culture a lot of people standing against, you know, whatever political party's in power right now. It's, you know, Donald Trump. You have satire. You have like the Jimmy Kimmels of the world who will just mercilessly mock what he thinks is wrong in Donald Trump's philosophy. And then you have a guy like Chuck Schumer, who's boring as the day is long and is trying to change things from a different, you know, and you hear both of them talking. One you want to listen to and think is, you know, kind of entertaining. Satire almost never gets to the solution. I'm not saying Chuck Schumer is going to get to a solution. That's not what I'm arguing for at all. But I'm saying satire almost never gets to the solution, like you're talking about. And that's, Erasmus had some satirical writings. He poked the bear, if you will, of the Catholic Church.
Well, and actually he writes this satirical writing and then goes and spends several months, a couple of years in England, you know, hobnobbing with the man who becomes Henry VIII, Prince Henry at the time. Erasmus ends up being very good friends with Thomas More.
Yeah. All the interesting characters at the time.
As we're learning the concept of what to be viral is, Erasmus's satire is published, and suddenly all of his elite intellectual friends are not so happy with him, and like people are like, no, we need to know about these abuses. Henry was on his side. Sir Thomas More is, you know, telling the monks and the clergy, you know, leave Erasmus alone. And really, Erasmus ends up, you know, not going through what Luther had to go through as far as being confronted about what he says about the church, because he's friends with the right people. Mm-hmm. And that ends up being both a similarity and a difference with Erasmus and Luther. Erasmus never had to suffer for what he believed in. Mm-hmm. He never had that kind of point. And you get the sense, like our analysis of Melanchthon, that he would have just crumbled.
Yeah,
like he would have,
for sure.
He would have just given up the whole thing.
I think, you know, Luther had a weak constitution to some degree and some health issues himself.
That's from the monastery.
But Erasmus, just his history, I don't know if he could have survived it.
No, physically. He wouldn't have. And Luther ends up having friends in the right places, but they are friends who preserve him as he suffers. And, you know, so Luther in 1521 at the Diet of Worms, Charles V tells him to, or no, it's Cajetan at the Diet of Worms. Well, now my history is fading me. One of those two asks him, recant all your teachings, and Luther comes back and says, I can't, you know, here I stand, is that, you know, the apocryphal thing that he says is like, unless I'm convinced by the word of God, I will not and I cannot recant, here I stand. And Erasmus never gets to that point. And Luther understands what Erasmus doesn't, is that if change is going to happen, if reform is going to happen in the church, a break with Rome is inevitable. Mm-hmm. And that ends up being the major conflict between Erasmus and Luther. The conflict is spearheaded in this debate on the bondage of the will about free will. That's what the issue distills down to, which is what we're going to talk about next week.
Yep.
But the big thing is Erasmus is comfortable in his criticism of the church, and Luther wants something to be done and ends up an enemy of the church. And I kind of think that's the way we should kind of view the historical situation.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see these two leading lights merging in on this and these really key historical moments. And I don't know if it's helpful for the listeners, but if you know the key dates of those early days with Luther and the posting of the 95 Theses and so on, and just drop in these details about Erasmus, you see them moving towards a clash. And so that's what we'll be getting to.
And you see them not only moving towards a clash, but almost being corralled into that. You know, it's
it was intentional, and there were obvious spiritual forces at work during that time for clear reasons. You know, if we believe that God is working, you know, in and through invisible beings, I mean, there's spiritual warfare. The powers, you know, it's not the earthly powers that they fight; it's the spiritual ones. And you can see those two, and it's funny the methods that they take. The way that we see the spiritual fight going and how it ends up becoming a thing. Yeah, that's I think it's interesting. Jason, you're looking up a quote here.
No, I'm not looking up a quote. I'm looking up, I promised the guy who was trying to get them both condemned at the same time.
Oh, yeah. The mutual enemy guy.
And I think his name, and again, church history isn't my thing, so if I'm wrong on the name because I can't find the bookmark now that I put there, I think the guy's name was like Aleander. Mm-hmm. Or something to that effect.
Yeah, it looks like Alexander without the X.
Yeah.
Yeah, Aleander. Yeah.
And he's the one. He hates Erasmus, and he hates Luther, and so he tries, the what got the ball rolling on this break is that he tries to lump together Erasmus's teachings with Luther's teachings as being equally heretical in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that is what, like, Erasmus, for his part, and I've never been a big Erasmus guy. I mean, probably that's in my Lutheran DNA. But, I mean, for the longest time, Erasmus is like, look, I haven't even read this guy. which I think is hilarious.
I glanced at a couple of his commentary on the Psalms, which looked
pages.
Fine.
Yeah. You know?
Like, I may have visited his blog once or twice. But, I mean, Erasmus is trying just not to get drawn into the fight at all. He's like, I have counseled him to back off.
Yeah.
And he's like, he's a virtuous man. I think he's been treated unfairly, but I think he's going about it the wrong way. And up until the break, and Luther takes the bait like a hungry northern pike. he hits and he runs with it, and he just goes.
Yeah, I've long said, like, just summarizing this interaction that we're going to get into the theology of it next week, I've long summarized this is Erasmus functionally writes like a pamphlet, like he like a simple blog post, and Luther just writes what becomes his most systematic, his most theological work. Just to tear them apart, and strewn in amongst that systematic theology are some of the most brutal insults.
Oh, yeah.
He just goes after this guy. And it's interesting, and we'll talk more about it next week, but it would be funny. When I think of this, I think of like some of those like Looney Tunes episodes from when we were kids. Like if you're younger, you maybe haven't watched Looney Tunes, but you know where there's that one trying to bait these two in and then kind of sneaks out. You know, you've seen like so many episodes like that. And it's true. And it would be funny if it wasn't so spiritually consequential.
Yeah. Well, it's that's where we're at. And so we'll set it up next week with what's the theology that gets them going. And we'll go from there.
Thank you for joining us. Please look us up on the web at beinglutheran.com. Also, invite a friend to check us out on Spotify and iTunes. Please join us next week as Pastor Jason, Pastor Brett, and Pastor Adam continue their discussion on the bondage of the will. If you would like more information about the Bible School or the seminary, please visit our website at flbc.edu. God bless you and have a great week.